The 80s. The man has had abs since the 80s. What is going on, John? What is going on?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Fate podcast for August 2019. I am your host, Jonathan Buchanan, and I am joined once again by my long-lost friend, fellow cinephile, Timothy Nelson. Good to see you, Tim.
Good to be here,
it
John.
It's been so long.
It's not just like a natural break that we took. There have been situations.
Yeah. We were not intending to take a break at all. In fact, we were going to come right back on. Let's see. Our last podcast was in May. We did Avengers Endgame, and we were ready to rock it again in June. We were going to do Booksmart, I remember. And then you decided at that point to take a vacation for like 3 weeks. It was beautiful. Well, I saw the pictures.
We thought Booksmart would be on Netflix.
Yeah. Because it's produced by Netflix, but no.
And it might be now. I have no idea. Is it on
Netflix? It's not yet. I really want to see it.
What do we got to do?
I've heard so many good things about it, but yeah, no, it's still not on Netflix.
But haven't I already paid for it, John?
Yeah,
isn't that where the money came from? My subscription is paying for that film already?
I thought that's one of the benefits of Netflix, is it should simultaneously release in theaters and Netflix. I don't get it. But anyway, the point is, you took a big, long vacation, and you went up. Remember that you showed me pictures? You went up to like a Grand Fishing Spot.
Is where I went.
Yeah.
Grand Fishing Spot, Montana.
There, Montana, okay, yeah.
I went all over. But yeah, what happened was, I'll just explain to everybody because they care so much.
They do.
So I went and I played and played and played, and I only got 3 or 4 hours of sleep and slept in a tent every night.
Because you were so excited.
Because I was like pumped every day. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not in Milwaukee. That's what happens, you see. You know, if you're not in Milwaukee, you have this zest for life. But you come back to the belt buckle of the Midwest, and it's just terrifying. But when you're out there, you're like, I better be awake most of the time because I got to go back to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And so I got really kind of sick, and I came back and I wasn't getting better, and I went to the doctor, and it turns out I have something that a lot of teenagers call the kissing disease.
Oh, boy.
It's mononucleosis.
Ah, yes.
But see, I'm a 41-year-old man, and so that's pretty rare. So they just told me to take it easy.
Uh-huh.
Which isn't always easy because I got 3 kids. So I'm supposed to take it easy and drink lots of fluids.
There it is.
That's it.
So in other words, June, we couldn't do it because you were living it up in Montana. And then in July, we couldn't do it because you basically dropped dead for like the whole month.
I had like the plague, and I was like, John, we better not do this.
Yeah.
Because
you were
I don't want you to have this.
Right.
And it worked out good because this is it didn't work out particularly good because I have a little spot in between jobs, and now it's filled with mono.
Right. And that month, we were going to do The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which we both saw and we're actually ready to talk about, which is a fantastic movie, by the way.
And then I got my mono diagnosis like the day before. Yeah,
right before we were going to do it.
And we both seen the film. It was great. You should see the film. You can't see the film. And
it's too late now. But it's coming. It's coming in like 2 weeks to streaming, actually. So it's all good.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, to rent on Amazon. It's coming. Yeah.
Go rent this film. Yes. It's a good film. I might rent it again just to watch it again. It was good.
Really good. So that's what happened. I am sorry, friends. It was not our intention. I mean, I get it. Like, we only podcast once a month. So 2 months is a very long time. I mean, I listen to a daily podcast called Today Explained. And when they come on at like 5 or 6 at night, and they usually come on at 3, I'm like, what's going on? It like ruins my whole day. So, I mean, there's got to be at least one person out there who was like, what's up? So that's the explanation. And we're back. And our intention is to be back for good for the rest of the year. We want to be faithful from now on. So please don't give up on us, and thank you for your patience.
Next time we'll have some kind of backup plan for you guys, but we were just on the, you know, we were on the fly.
Yep.
We didn't know what to do.
That's right.
Things were tough. Times were hard.
So Tim, we got a ton to cover today, but briefly, I did want to leave a spot since it's been a really, really long time for everyone's favorite segment, What Have We Been Watching? Have you been watching anything? You did get a lot of downtime, but was there anything that you've been able to
watch? So I was trying to sleep. And if I try to watch a movie, sometimes I'll fall asleep, but sometimes I won't. So I've been trying to go to sleep with no movie.
It totally makes sense. So nothing's on your radar.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I've been watching some in prep for the podcast today, watching some Tarantino flicks. And I also have been watching, trying to get into some of these series that, you know, streaming series. So I tried to get into this Dairy Girls.
I haven't heard of that one.
It's like some, it's like a teen, it's about teen girl, Irish girls in the 90s.
Okay. On what platform?
I don't know. I guess I'm getting it. I think it's on Netflix.
Okay.
I think. Maybe it's not. Anyway, it's kind of funny.
Not so much.
It's kind of, it's pretty funny. The characters are fun. Mm-hmm. It's not great, but it's all right. But other than that, like, no, not a whole lot. Right. It was a good opportunity to do it, but I don't know. You ever go through, I think our listeners must go through this too, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have these periods where you just don't, you're not inspired by anything that you see.
Yeah.
And you go, man, you know, there's some great movies out there that I've already seen, but I'm not inspired. And then you'll, and then I know I go through like a binge, like I find a director, a new director who might be old. Mm-hmm. And I go, I've got to watch every single thing they did.
Right.
So, yeah, I was in one of these periods where I was like, nothing was really moving me.
Nothing was jumping out, inspiring.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I, once again, have been watching some TV. And let me just say, as we've discussed before, that I know it's weird to talk about TV on a cinema podcast, but I want it to be known for all the listeners out there that this is actually the only place on Cinema Faith that we ever talk about TV. In fact, I have recently turned down some articles and reviews from some of our best writers who didn't understand that that is not our jam and wrote some compelling reviews of TV shows. And I've been like, I'm sorry, that is just not going to fly on our website. And they were crushed. But that is why this segment right here is so special.
You hypocrite.
Because for, yeah. I know.
You
because,
hypocrite.
Because for the most dedicated fans of Cinema Faith, they get this little Easter egg embedded in the podcast where you won't find a trace of TV anywhere on the site, but right here and now is the place where you can get your fix. So that's why this is special, and that's why I will always reserve this for a little TV action. And I am sorry, because that is really hypocritical.
It's okay. I'm judging you. The listeners are judging you.
Yes.
So dogs, with, cats, with they're that, judging you.
With that preface, I want to recommend heartily season one of Killing Eve. You've probably heard about this, right? People have talked about this show.
I just heard from you.
Really?
Tell me more.
Well, if you follow a lot of top 10 lists, this was on a lot of season and top 10 lists maybe 2 years ago. I'm always way behind the eight ball. I'm never like currently involved in the hit show. But back a couple years ago, everyone was talking about this show, and it is totally up to the hype. So Sandra Oh is, you know her. She was in Sideways, and she was in Grey's Anatomy. She's a great actress. You don't know her.
No, I know who Sandra Oh is.
Sandra,
gives,
okay.
She gives
okay.
me the pet. She gives me the. She gives me reason to hate.
Ah, okay.
I'm not a fan of Sandra Oh's style.
That's okay.
Acting or Saturday Night Live appearances.
Well, she is great in this, and she's a detective named Eve, and she is trying to track down a female assassin named Oksana, who's played by Jodie Comer, and it is a great show because it's one of those that you see both sides of the law, right? You follow Sandra Oh as this detective and you follow the assassin, and both are compelling, but the assassin totally steals the show. Jodie Comer, she's amazing. She's funny.
What, Sandra Oh isn't the best?
She's really good, and she was nominated for an Emmy and a Golden Globe and the whole nine yards, but Jodie Comer totally steals the show. But to be fair, it's a more fun role. You get to be an assassin, and you get to be snarky and stuff like that, right? It's a no contest, but she's really great. Both are great, though, and it's streaming right now on Hulu. You can go watch this. If you have a Hulu subscription right now, all of season one, it's only 8 episodes. They're pretty short episodes, and I promise you will not be disappointed. It's really, really, really
Is
good.
It like kind of a neo-noir kind of deal?
Kind
like-
of, but it's very tongue-in-cheek. It's almost, I would almost give call it a dark comedy because it's not super serious, but it does have enough weight to it to make it compelling, but it's not like one of those super serious, like dark Fincher type things. Yeah.
Yeah. So like high stakes, but it's also funny.
It's also fun and all funny. Right, right. So very worth checking out. All right.
For all you Sandra Oh fans out there, can't get enough.
Not Tim Nelson, apparently.
I'm not.
Dang.
Brutal. Watch Sandra. Here's what I want to tell
okay.
you. I want you to watch the last season, Sandra Oh, last season on Saturday Night Live, and I want you to try to laugh anytime she's on camera.
Maybe comedy just isn't her jam.
Maybe a detective. That's like more like her thing. A detective, awkward friend.
Right.
But it just soured
Saturday
me.
Night Live
it
doesn't work for everybody.
That's why. Yeah. So maybe it's their fault, not hers.
Yeah, right.
It's a problem with the booking.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, there's other problems. I have other shows I don't like Sandra Oh in, but that's the most recent one. Mm-hmm. Made me go, ugh.
Remember that John Delaney comedy special we watched? So funny.
Yes.
It's called Mr. No. The not The Comeback Kid. That was his old one. I forget what it's called. Anyway, doesn't matter. It's on Netflix. It's his most recent one. John Delaney is one of the funniest stand-up comics I have ever seen, and I watched it with you. But anyway, he used to be a writer on Saturday Night Live, and he has this hilarious story about when Mick Jagger came on the set and just like kept insulting every joke he would come up with in the writer's room. He just kept going, "Not funny!" And it's a really, really good bit.
But that's anyway, great. Yeah. See? Yeah. Totally I love that. It. See, Mick Jagger sounds kind of funny.
He does, actually.
Now, yeah. So that's a problem. This is reminding me that I think wait a minute, I might have watched something. Oh, yes, Comedians. We're talking about comedy here.
Yeah.
So I have been watching, there was a new season of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
Oh, I watched a couple episodes. Yeah, yeah.
And I love that show.
I don't like it, and only because I think Jerry is kind of like the most stereotypical white privileged dude ever, and it's kind
he's
of annoying.
Jewish.
I get it. I know, but I mean, just like the fact that he just like, you know, he's this guy who goes around, is famous, and he's got tons of money, and he just sort of like goes around sort of like grumbling about things, and he just is like, dude,
but that's the point.
You have every
he gets Jamie Foxx and him in a dive coffee shop, which because here it's kind of like we feel like we're the friend, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So we all drive cars, or at least we ride in them from time to time.
Yeah,
we all drink coffee. Most of us drink coffee, and so we do these things, and we meet with friends for coffee. Now we're like part of it's voyeuristic. We're like part of this crew, and these guys are normal, but they're not.
But they're not normal.
They drive cars, but they don't drive normal cars, right?
Right, right.
It's like part of the. It's like voyeuristic, but it's also gives you insight into comedy. Which I think is kind of neat. Yeah. But you're saying you hate it so much.
I think Jerry's annoying in real life. Yeah, I just think he kind of walks around kind of snooty, like he's above everything because he's got every opportunity in the world. Yeah.
He's got the Sandra Oh factor.
Maybe.
I know what you mean.
But I love Ricky Gervais, and so I watch the episodes with him. And so, yeah, there you go.
I think that's good.
All right. Well, Tim, here we go, man. We better get to it. So,
all right.
We are not talking about just any movie today. We are talking about the 9th movie from Quentin Tarantino. As the moniker says in the trailer, this is the big film, man. We've been waiting for this a while. We were talking about this a few months ago. Remember when I saw the poster and I had no idea what it was about. And all we knew back in the day was Tarantino's making a movie about the Manson murders. And all of us simultaneously were like, oh, no. Right?
Yeah.
So that's all we knew. But
so much opportunity for
So much opportunity for crass ultra violence, but we've seen it and we are here to report on Mr. Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This movie stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie. So first of all,
can I admit something to you?
Yeah, go ahead.
I hadn't seen Dakota Fanning in a long time.
Dakota Fanning.
She's in the flick. She's like one of the Manson followers.
I didn't recognize
Red.
Her. Yeah.
Anyway, she's like the one that's like in the house with at the Spahn Ranch.
That's Dakota Fanning.
So, yeah.
She has some makeup on, man. So,
well, yeah.
Some prosthetics.
I hadn't seen Dakota Fanning in about 10 years. And I was like, I thought, what's the Robbie lady?
Margot Robbie.
I thought that was Dakota Fanning. And I was like, Dakota Fanning grew like 2 feet. I'm like, and turned into a supermodel.
No.
I thought for the whole film, I thought, I was like, dang. What's going on?
Wow, I had no idea.
I didn't know either.
Yeah.
So she's in. So Dakota Fanning,
she's
little Dakota Fanning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The child actress.
She was young, and now she has grown up.
But I thought I was like that. Oh, she's got blonde hair.
So she was Margot Robbie.
Yeah, and I'm like, I started thinking about it. I'm like, child actor, 6 foot tall? Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah, but anyway, that confused me the whole movie. I was like, is that really Dakota Fanning? Every time I saw her.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
So, first question. What is this movie about? Like I said, we saw the poster and we totally took a guess. This is actually recorded where I took a stab because I don't like to read plot synopsis. I hate spoiling the movie for myself. So I literally was guessing about what the movie was about. And I said something on the podcast about, I think it's maybe like they're like detectives and they're partners and they're investigating the Manson murders. Totally not what this movie is about. So I apologize to you.
I like that idea.
Anyway, it's a fun idea. That's what it looked like on the poster. I was just going off that. But anyway, what the movie is actually about is... So DiCaprio plays this fictional actor. This is all set back in the late 60s, like 1969. And DiCaprio plays this fictional actor named Rick Dalton. And Brad Pitt plays his stunt double named Cliff Booth. So Rick Dalton is like this sort of this Western guy who plays in like Western TV shows.
He's an amalgam of a bunch of different characters.
Like who in real life?
Oh gosh, I don't have all the names in my head. They're on. Go look up some reviews and you'll get all the names.
Were any of those shows real that he was on, like FBI or?
There were some of the real shows. I don't know if FBI was real or not.
Okay.
Some of those shows they were referring to were real.
Yeah.
The director Wanamaker is a real dude.
Okay.
Most of the stuff that could be real is real, or it's combining two different things.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty accurate. Now, if you go, he is, so this, the relationship between Pitt and DiCaprio is based on Burt Reynolds and his stuntman.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, so Burt Reynolds' stuntman lived in his back house for 14 years.
Holy cow.
Yeah, absolutely. And ended up writing Cannonball Run. And then Burt Reynolds is like, why don't you direct these other ones and a whole bunch of other ones.
That's incredible.
It's freaking crazy.
Yeah. So
or maybe it was Smokey and the Bandit and Cannonball Run. But anyway, so it turns out the stuntman's kind of like a genius, but like Burt Reynolds is like still like really connected to the dude.
Yeah. And so it's the same thing in the movie. You've got Brad Pitt is his stunt double, and he basically like watches his house when he's not working, and Dalton is off doing a movie or whatever. He like fixes stuff around his house, and then he goes home to this like trailer that's in the back of some drive-in lot. And so, yeah, he's totally kind of, they're connected, but he is definitely piggybacking off of him, just sort of like this Burt Reynolds stunt double. That's really cool.
But what we're dealing with is like a hyper-masculine mm-hmm. cowboy figure who is redemptive violence leads the way.
Yes, in Brad Pitt's character.
So you clean up the town.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Brad Pitt's character. I'll say DiCaprio's character is the same way. So the idea is that if you're going to solve kind of injustice, you need somebody that's willing to get their hands dirty and do the redemptive violence work.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it through power and through, you know, hurting people.
Right. And then right alongside that story is this other budding story about Sharon Tate. Now, Sharon Tate, of course, if you know anything about the Manson murders, was in real life the wife of Roman Polanski, famous director
if
Roman Polanski.
If you know
Polanski.
Anything about the Manson murders.
Right, I know. Not that you should. But
if you've studied the Manson murders and the crime photos, and you know
come on, we
whose
all watched,
blood was on what.
We all watched Eat Your Hollywood Stories in high school. We've got this.
If you've studied the Manson murders like John has.
Yes. Anyway, Roman Polanski.
If you
Polanski,
have blood splatter pattern detection.
Hey, dude, Forensic Files is my jam. That show freaks me out.
You're freaking me out. Oh. It is freaky, but don't watch it.
I know.
But you like that
guy's
stuff.
Voice. I mean, I do until it's 11 o'clock at night, and I'm like, why you're did I watch
help
that?
Me.
It's like you feel like someone is definitely going to come kill you soon. I mean, like, it's going to happen. Yeah, those shows are scary. Anyway.
We need a hero.
The point is, yes, yes. We'll get to that. The point is, Roman Polanski was a director back in the day of such famous hits as Rosemary's Baby, and more recently, The Pianist is one of his better films from the past decade. But anyway, he back then, he was very young, and his wife's name was Sharon Tate, and he was gone on a European vacation, or he was shooting a movie, I think, in Europe, and his wife, Sharon Tate, was brutally murdered while pregnant. That is what happened in real life. And so that is what we expect to happen in this movie. We know the story, and so we have alongside this sort of buddy comedy thing going on with DiCaprio and Pitt, Sharon Tate as this aspiring actress, kind of seeing herself in film for the first time, and it's all kind of heading to some sort of climax, and I'm not going to spoil that here, but that is sort of what's happening. Those are the two basic plot threads that are coming along in the movie, and they converge at some point. So that is the basic plot of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Anything you want to add to that as far as just getting a basic idea of what the film is like?
No, I think you covered it pretty well.
All right. Cool. So we've talked about Quentin Tarantino before. If you actually, you can go back and listen to our podcast on The Hateful Eight, which we both, I believe, did not like. You didn't like The Hateful Eight, right?
I liked elements of The Hateful Eight.
Okay.
Overall, I thought it was, I think I'd probably give it a B.
Yeah, that's exactly what I gave it.
So I loved all whole bunch of the, I like the bells and whistles of The Hateful Eight. I like the acting in The Hateful Eight. I like the cinematography in The Hateful Eight.
The 70 millimeter presentation,
I love
right?
the 70 millimeter presentation of The Hateful Eight. And I like some of the thematic elements of The Hateful Eight, but as a film, it fails.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Definitely.
It
does.
I mean, it's not like a total failure, but it's just not, it doesn't take you to the place that an A movie would take you.
You know what? I'll never forget about The Hateful Eight is it opens on a cross, and you looked over at me like, here we go.
Yeah.
It was going to be great. But then it was all downhill from there. Anyway, so if you want to go back and listen to that podcast, that's actually where we do a big deep dive into Tarantino. We go through our favorite movies of his. We kind of walk through his filmography. So that is our huge Tarantino episode. So we won't go too in-depth here on him. But Tim, in a brief nutshell, how would you describe your thoughts on Quentin Tarantino?
So probably most of us first encountered him with Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. And then we went, oh, I better watch another movie he made. And you go back to Reservoir Dogs. You're like, oh, that's cool.
I like was his first one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my brief thoughts on Tarantino is that he's sophisticated. He knows, he's almost like a historiographer of film.
Yeah.
He loves stuff from the late 60s through the 70s, but late 60s, early 70s. And he loves stuff that's not good film or traditionally viewed as something worth up, like lifting up.
B movies.
He loves spaghetti westerns. He loves Sergio Leone. Mm-hmm. He loves spaghetti westerns. He loves grindhouse flicks. We talk about this a little bit. And he's okay with hyperviolence, and he's into all the minutia of what develops in the 60s and 70s as far as film goes. That's not the stuff that works, like going, oh, it's not all Scorsese. It's not these directors like Polanski. It's not all these directors that we would think of as being definitive of that era. It's other weird stuff that you wouldn't. That
right.
He wants to bring to the surf and say, this stuff was here too.
So he has a deep reverence for all kinds of film. And I know that because he actually does do a top 10 list currently every now and then. He'll come out with a top 10 list and there are like current, you know, movies. So he's not a snob in the sense that it's like only the movies no one's ever heard of, but he does tend to have a deep affinity for the movies just underneath the surface of what everyone's talking about, the hidden gems that kind of, that he pulls out there. And it's also fair to say that he's a very polarizing figure, right? You kind of either love him or you hate him. I've talked to a lot of people that just cannot stand Tarantino and refuse to watch anything he does.
So the initial reaction to him, I think, was wrong, which the initial reaction you have is, oh, he is a shock. It's like people react to his film like you'd react to Howard Stern.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's just shocking.
Yep.
Oh, he's going to just push the envelope. He'll do whatever he can to shock everybody.
Yep.
And if it needs to be one level grosser, one level more violent, if he needs to have characters have a conversation that they never would, that we've never seen on film, he's going to do it.
Yep.
But that's a misunderstanding of him. To me, he'll take polarized views and I'll put them right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
He likes unexpected. He likes evocative scenes and stuff that are derivative, but also from other movies, but also referential. Yeah. So I would say that he's definitely a feminist. That's something that...
Well, that's the controversial element because he's come under a lot of fire recently for kind of putting his female characters through the ringer. Like, does there always have to be a rape scene, you know, where they rise from the ashes of being totally brutalized to get their revenge, you know, in the end? And so some people have criticism for that recently, but I see both sides of that coin because you also have the feminist element when they kind of rise up and you're talking about, you know, Death Proof and Kill Bill and stuff. But to get there, he puts them through hell and back, right? So is it really necessary?
Well, like, yeah, so like part of it would be like to be a woman in our culture is to already be subjected to all these horrible things. Now, I don't speak from any point of experience.
Right.
But the idea is that like you're already at this disadvantage from a power standpoint. And so he has these characters that take power back through the use of power.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you see it most, I think Kill Bill, you see it the most graphically, but you see it in a lot of different movies. Like what's the grindhouse one? I just saw this for the first time in the last couple months.
Death Proof.
Yeah. So that's the other movie that has a stunt person in it. And it's a stunt
with
woman.
Kurt Russell.
And she's incredibly famous. I can't remember her name. Oh,
yeah. Kurt Russell plays a stunt guy, but then there's an actual real life stunt woman who Zoe Bell or something like that. But yeah,
I think it is. So she is like, basically she's a total badass.
She's great. Yeah.
Like in real life.
Yeah.
But she never gets highlighted. She doesn't quite meet all the like cutesy actress, you know, kind of because she's tough. Right.
Yep. Yep.
And it's like, we're not ready for that. So she's tough. She's and anyway, he highlights her in that film.
The ending of that movie where they just like take turns punching Kurt Russell and then it just ends on that perfect musical note at right before the credits. It gets me every time.
Yeah. But that movie is like obviously like very rough compared to the film that we are reviewing, but that doesn't claim to be anything but.
Right. So basically, long story short, if you just judge Tarantino on the surface, if you're just counting up swear words, if you're doing the typical things that we hate here at Cinema Faith, you know, if you're documenting all of the torture and sex and violence, you're going to have a lot to hate in Tarantino and you can instantly write him off. But if you're able to look underneath the surface, he really is a genuine artist who brings a really unique voice to film, and he's indispensable. And
if you want to get offended going into a Tarantino flick, you will.
Yeah.
And you might get offended even if you're not trying to get offended. But what I would say is, like, look past the surface level of what's going on, and maybe there's bigger meta messages that he's trying to give, or he's trying to point out something in us. He tends to enjoy pointing out inconsistencies in the way the audience thinks. And he uses us and he plays with us. We're kind of a toy for him in some ways. That's how I look at it.
Yeah. So what is Tarantino trying to do with this particular film, Once Upon a Time? What is he really going for here from a stylistic perspective, the whole nine yards? Yeah.
I don't know. So I've been thinking about it, right?
Okay.
I can give you ideas, but they're kind of nothing. With Tarantino stuff, a lot of times it'll happen like 3 years after the fact. It'll be like, oh my gosh, I think this might be a significant thing that he's feeding us with. I think, but I could talk about a few of those things. What do you think?
Well, I think one place to start is that it definitely seems to be a love letter to an old school Hollywood, right? Like, I specifically saw him interviewed and he mentioned that he wanted to recreate like the Sunset Boulevard that he remembered when he was six, you know? So it's definitely a nostalgic kind of piece in that way.
Right. Yeah. Cause, and you know, just having lived in LA, like he does it, and I didn't live when I was, you know, in 1969, I was not alive. But he does take everything that still exists there and he does highlight it basically from the rest of the Mexican restaurants. It's amazing that the Mexican restaurants would exist. That would be one of the things, right?
Yeah.
But it seems like he does a good job. I think that you have a clash of narratives, like with it, like you have an old narrative and a new narrative and they're coming together and you're at this kind of this liminal transitional period in Hollywood where the old narrative is dying and a new narrative is taking over. And it's the summer of love. It's 69. We landed on the moon, Woodstock, and Helter Skelter too, right? So these killings. And we're at this point as culturally, like the zeitgeist is like, no, it's no longer Steve McQueen who everyone wants to be. Now it's Peter Fonda. So the idea is like seeking this true freedom rather than to be a hero through violence. So it's being a tough guy.
Interesting.
So it's kind of like in some ways it's like the last shred of like where the transition from where everyone wanted to be a cowboy or this kind of Western narrative, right?
Easy Rider, all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Easy Rider is different because that's actually that masks itself in a cowboy genre too. I mean, the motorcycles are horses, but what I would say, well, the whole thing is about freedom and they're going backwards, right? So they go from the West to New Orleans. But anyway.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sidetrack.
No, it's a total sidetrack. But I would say less, Easy Rider is actually more
new culture.
That's the new culture.
Okay, gotcha.
I would say the old one is more like the Western, like the John Wayne.
Okay.
And so that the new hero is bucking the establishment. The old hero is trying to protect the establishment, like, or protect these values from people who are assaulting the values.
Interesting. And that's what Dalton, played by DiCaprio, is kind of struggling with, is that he is this sort of at the peak of that period, and he sees himself kind of futureless because things are changing all around him, right?
Right. And he's getting older. So he's And the other thing would be like, the idea is that when there is no law, that somebody with power who is moral would step in, like bounty law, right? Mm. Bounty law is like, hey, we're on a frontier and we don't really have a functioning justice system. So we need some strong male figure to come in and to clean the place up.
That's the show that Rick Dalton, the actor, is on, Bounty Law. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you were a kid during that time, that rings true for you a lot. This whole idea of bounty justice. Hey, if this isn't going to work, we're going to have a strong male figure come in and fix it. And then the other idea being that women are more empowered. So even the Manson women are like more empowered.
Right.
In this film.
Yeah.
So that there would be a group of, and you see that showdown like in the Brad Pitt scene when he goes to Spahn Ranch.
Oh, it's my favorite scene.
And it's like, could all those women take Brad Pitt? And you're like, I bet they could.
Yeah.
And they can kind of feel that power rising and you can kind of feel him losing his power.
But they're still kind of stuck in between the transitionary period, right? Because they go and try to get the dude on the horseback instead of just
which
sort
is of hilarious. Because what's Tex going to do to Brad Pitt?
Right.
Not a darn thing. But the women could have taken Brad Pitt if they chose to.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that women are beginning to be empowered. Mm-hmm. In this time period, but they don't quite step into it yet. Even Manson, like these Manson women, right? Like these absolute cult follower, you know, women are beginning to step into that power.
And both Dalton and Cliff Booth seem a little threatened by it because they're always like just freaking hippies. Like, you know, that's like what they say all the time throughout the whole movie is that it's just like these hippies keep showing up and they seem very disgusted by the whole thing. Yeah. Awesome. So let's go to the acting elements here. So we've got an all-star cast, obviously. Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt. So these were his first choices for the role of Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth, and you honestly couldn't ask for a better pair. I mean, like from the moment I saw those two names, it didn't matter if it was a Tarantino film or not. I'm going to see them in anything. I believe this is the first time they've been together. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. So they were both on Growing Pains, but I don't think they were actually like acted together, but they both
Wait,
were on that show.
They've never been together in
a film
before?
They've never been together in a film. I'm fairly certain about that. Yeah.
Huh.
So it's quite a pairing. And yeah, so let's do them one at a time. Leonardo DiCaprio as Rick Dalton. What are your thoughts on his performance?
Oh, it's great. It's like exactly what you expect from an A-list actor who has proven himself over and over and over again. He's great. He's a complex character. The writing is good, so that helps him. He plays an alcoholic who's kind of washed up, and he's trying to, and he does a really, really good job at that.
I don't think Leonardo DiCaprio gets enough credit for being funny. Like, he really does have that skill set, and he does it in a way that isn't obviously funny. It's always through a serious character, but I mean, just look at that scene where he's trashing his trailer just because he's so mad at himself that he keeps forgetting his lines on set. I mean, that is like hilarious, but it's played perfectly by him.
Yeah, the timing and when he takes a drink and then and he does it in a way that's just like everybody, like he relieves the tension in an instant.
Yeah,
which is what I mean. That's good comedy. But what I think he's good. I think he is primarily he plays the straight character.
Of course.
He plays like the tough guy. Not tough guy, he plays the protagonist who
he does cry a lot.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt's really the tough guy, yeah.
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 But he plays a tough guy, but he is like a milder version of Brad Pitt with more sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as far as his roles, right?
Mm-hmm. He's the kind of actor that doesn't like disappear into his roles like Christian Bale, you know, he doesn't have that physical effect. You always know it's DiCaprio, but he always brings something totally unique to every role I've ever seen him play. You know, if you think back to just the breadth of his roles, like from Titanic to Inception to The Revenant, just he's always bringing something very different to every role, even though it's always Leo as compared to like Bale, where he just sort of likes to be swallowed up by, you know, physically. He's kind of like Tom Hanks in that way, where it's always Tom, but he still brings something unique to every role, and so it doesn't feel like he just keeps replaying the same sort of thing over and over again. So I love Leo.
The fact
I've always
I didn't
been
think too much about him means he probably did a great job.
Exactly.
I'm like, oh yeah, he's that guy.
So then Brad Pitt, man, another actor with a lot of comic timing. If you think back to like Ocean's 11, you know, the first Ocean's 11, which I stand by as being a genuinely great film. Fight Club, I think he's actually really funny in that. 12 Monkeys, you know, where he plays that really weird character in 12 Monkeys. You've seen that, right? With Bruce Willis. So yeah, he's got that serious side, but he also has that comic side too. And is just a guy you can do anything in film. So what do you think of him as Cliff Booth? What struck you there?
I liked him because he is the hero that these guys are all playing.
Oh, interesting. In real life.
Well, like not in real life, but in the light. Like,
In the movie. Like,
so he's the stuntman. Yeah. The first scene sets it up. He's like, so what do you do? He's like, well, I guess I do carry this guy's load. And
right.
He does.
Right. Right.
So basically he does all the stuff that he takes all the pain for the actors that aren't willing to take it. He's complex. Apparently he killed his wife, but we don't know the details on all that, right?
It's a weird scene on the boat where he's...
You're not really sure. Did he shoot her with that gun? What happened?
Right.
So apparently he killed his wife. It's like this, you know, disputed as this accidental. It's just not. Mm-hmm. We don't really know the backstory, but it's enough to make him like kind of get on the outs with all the directors in Hollywood.
This is a funny scene. Can we just talk about that boat scene? This is just like perfect Tarantino. So he does Tarantino does a lot of like flashbacks in this movie, but that scene in particular. So it's just they're talking about how he killed his wife, and all we see is they're on this boat together, him and his wife's just berating him, just like you're the worst. I can't believe I married you. Blah 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 blah. And he's just taking it.
He's in a in this cheesy looking wetsuit.
Yeah, kind of like Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, and he puts on this little mask and he opens up a beer, and the beer like splashes onto his.
Absolutely.
That's all
like
you see.
It's like silly almost.
That's it. I just love that scene.
So apparently, yeah, we don't know exactly what happens there, but it's enough to like make his character like kind of like where you're like, nah, I don't know about this cat.
Right.
But what he does is he's a war hero. He's all this other things. And then he is like just a total badass. Like he's, you know, beating up Bruce Lee.
Yeah, a lot of controversy there. The Bruce Lee estate did not love that scene.
So what?
They said that he was not like that in real life at all. He was not a jerk. And Tarantino really put it, made him portrayed like he was.
But this whole film is like total conjecture, man.
I guess.
Like, look at the ending of this film.
Right. It's
like
this film is
exploration based in fact, but not real.
Right.
So what they're saying is a character who does not exist,
but
is bad mouthing Bruce Lee, and they're mischaracterizing Bruce Lee. So what?
He did use Bruce Lee's name as compared to Brad Pitt is playing a fictional character. So I mean, you can understand being a little upset about that.
But like, here's my question.
Yeah.
But I mean, they don't like totally disrespect him. He doesn't totally get his butt kicked. My question would be, do you really think Bruce Lee could beat up Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay at this point?
No, but they say he never would have said something like that. Like, that's the whole point. They say that Tarantino has a vendetta against Bruce Lee because of the kind of movies that he prefers over Lee's films or something like that. I didn't read the whole article, but
that is interesting because Lee's stuff is like right there. But if you ever, I mean, have you watched a bunch of Bruce Lee movies?
No. I watched one Bruce Lee movie, the Drunken Tiger.
Okay.
Whatever. Doesn't matter.
So I watched a ton of Bruce Lee movies.
Okay.
And like, it doesn't, like, he is a self-promoter, like 100% a self-promoter.
Hmm.
And so like, I could see him self-promoting at every chance he gets because he's scrapping to like basically become this film star.
Yeah.
I mean, the dude's like a Chinese film star in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, that's kind of amazing. He had to scrap to do that. So I can see him being self-promoting. I'm not saying he said that to somebody who is not even a real person, but I wouldn't say like, I think they could characterize that. It's not like an actual event. Come on, guys.
I'm with you. It's a great scene though.
I mean, they're characterizing everyone else in that, right? They got all kinds of directors, all kinds of people. The stuntman's being characterized.
True.
So why is, I don't feel like Bruce Lee should be off limits. I'm not exactly sure why.
Yeah. All right. They're an uproar. But I love that scene where he goes flying into the side of that truck. It's awesome.
Yeah. If your body did that to a car, you would not be getting up.
Right. Yeah. So the only criticism I'll make about Brad Pitt is I feel like he picks his movies really well. He picks the material well. But I do feel like as compared to what I just said about DiCaprio, it does always feel like that's Brad Pitt being Brad Pitt. Like he always has that same sort of like halting cadence, you know, where he just sort of like pauses and then just does this little smirk and purses his lips. You know, it's like that Brad Pitt like look. He brings that to like every single role. So I don't think he disappears inside his characters, even though he's always enjoyable. That's the only thing.
But he is the cowboy that we want.
Right. Yeah.
And so like, so all these, so like they play these parts, but they also are, so he's a stuntman, but he also in the film, he is the real cowboy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, he's the guy that saves the day. He's the guy that takes the bullet. He's the guy that does all those things.
Right.
And so, for like, I like, he may lack dimension, but he also has a certain morality to him. I mean, it's not like perfect, but there is a certain morality to him. So he's like not gonna have sexual relations with like an underage girl.
That's right.
And he's like real clear about it. He's like, no, I'm not going to jail for you.
Yes.
He said, I've avoided jail thus far and I'm not going for you. So there's like some things. And then he gets this, I think at Spawn Ranch, he gets this heroic sense of like, he is a moral man that you don't ever see you don't get that with DiCaprio. DiCaprio, you get, he wants to keep making movies and he's self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
He so even sort of turns his back on. Oh,
Right.
And the and then the Brad Pitt character is like, hey, Italian movies sound great. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you looking at this? You're looking at this the wrong way. You're going to keep working.
That's a good point. Even when he runs into conflict with that one character at Spahn Ranch, he gives him the opportunity to fix it, right? And that's interesting.
But I don't think just that character. What I was thinking of is that he deeply cares for the well-being of Spahn. Mm. And he's willing, like he's seeing that he's walking into this trap.
Yep.
And we're all feeling like, well, you're going to go. You're going to get toasted here.
Yeah, we're all feeling like these excuses
he's gonna
are total
He's going to get murdered
and
buried in the desert.
Right, right.
And he goes and he keeps going and he's really trying to make sure this guy who he had contact with 15 years ago or 8 years ago, whatever, make sure the old guy is not being taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what he's trying to do. And he goes to these extreme lengths. He doesn't have to do that.
Right. That's a good
and
point.
And I think he begins to take on at that point, and he's caring for this guy who's an alcoholic and he's trying to like...
Who's yelling at him basically to get lost. Yeah.
He lives in a trailer. This guy lives in the hills. He's, you know, eating macaroni and cheese every night. And he still cares for this guy. And he does like one key scene that I keep thinking about over and over again is when he's the one that puts the TV antenna back up onto the roof when it blows over.
Mm.
And the idea is like he provides so then they watch FBI together.
Yeah, man, you're right. He is a very kind of a humble servant throughout the movie, which is interesting. It's interesting contrast with kind of the macho man that he is.
Like I carry his load.
Yeah,
and at the end he
never complains. Yeah,
doesn't complain. He goes and picks him up no matter what. He does everything. He shows him respect the whole film.
Yep.
He sits in coach where the other guy sits in first class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he does everything, and it's not like he's bitter about it. He's just like, here, this is who I am in the world. My yep. job is to take what this guy can't. And so I think that's really interesting. But I also like, and I look at him as incredibly moral in the film, even though who knows about, like, did he kill his wife? What went on there?
Mm-hmm.
But he seems like a very moral character in the midst of, like, kind of this bizarre morality of, A, the Hollywood character, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, B, the Manson characters.
Yeah.
So... Like, is the, you know, and it makes me go, like, is the Polanski, yeah, it's interesting, but it makes me go, like, is Polanski any more, who's more of the narcissist, Polanski or Manson? You know?
Well, we don't
portray,
see.
They portray him as, like, both of them as, like, being reckless nuts, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I don't know. I mean, I think Manson, of course, was the more nut.
Well, of
one.
Course. Yeah. Although Polanski went on, of course, to
get
have sex with a minor
and get kicked out of the country.
self-exile himself out of the country. He still,
because you go to jail.
Yeah, supposedly, if he steps foot in the United States, still to this day, he'd get arrested and put in jail for that.
Right.
But so he hides out in Europe and still making movies.
There you go.
There you go. Last major character is Margot Robbie. She first entered my radar in The Wolf of Wall Street. She played Leonardo DiCaprio's wife, and this is the one you thought was.
Dakota Fanning. I was like, geez, Dakota Fanning grew.
And she was Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad, which I thought she was brilliant in that, and I didn't think that movie was that terrible, but she really made it great. And then she was recently last year in Mary, Queen of Scots, which wasn't a great movie, but she was really good in it. So she's really come a long way really, really, really fast. Like, she kind of burst on the scene in Wolf of Wall Street like 2 years ago, and she's basically made it.
So the way I look at her is she is like Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
Which is... She's not a household name.
And, not yet.
And
yeah.
People, and like when you, like my response to her is like, if she came up to the theater I was working in, I'd be like, who are you? You're in what movie? Oh, it doesn't look like you.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so I think she really is like Tate.
Right.
She's that, I think she might
she's
be
at that level right now. Right.
She's
basically
a similar age that Tate was.
She looks a lot like her too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's part of the whole like, yeah, yeah, why you might pick her out. But anyway.
Yeah. No, I know.
No, but I know what you're saying. She really
yeah.
does.
Yeah.
But I think the idea is like she's just, I think Tarantino, I think his casting is very deliberate, that she is a lot like her in the sense of that she's not a household name. She has some promise, but she also, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Do you think that she's underwritten as a character? She's very one-dimensional in the movie, and I could see two sides of it. I could see it being on purpose because she's kind of like this fairy tale angelic figure, especially what happens in the end, which we'll talk about in a minute. But like, she definitely has very little depth to her character. She just sort of floats in and around, you know, gets her little feet shot in that Tarantino loves in the back of the chairs in the theater. Just like, I don't know, just kind of, she's a prop, it feels like, a little bit to me.
You get a sense of her character, which is she's willing to drive way out of her way to see herself in a film because she kind of almost doesn't believe that she's good enough to be in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then she has to tell people she's in the film so that they can go, wow, you were in that film.
That's true.
And the film is kind of like exploiting her even.
Yeah, yeah. She's this klutz who just sort of keeps falling
falls down in her underwear. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like she has to like keep revisiting this stupid film in order to like kind of keep her self-confidence up.
Hmm.
And she has to keep going to the Playboy Mansion parties and like be with Polanski and do all these things that kind of keep her confidence up. So I think there's like a kind of a, because of that, you feel a sense of deep vulnerability, and you also know that she's going to die.
Right. Right. Kind of adds that impending dread. Yeah.
Oh, like just the name,
mm-hmm.
like Sharon Tate, you hear that name and that's like immediately if you've, you know, studied any like Hollywood in the 60s, that's like, oh no, mm-hmm. this is going to be awful.
And you could definitely make an argument for him building you up towards that with her being kind of this just light, just sort of like always smiling, always just sort of like floating along. Yeah.
Right. So she's not like a Manson character. So like that's a contrast, right? Mm-hmm. So she's not like one of these Manson followers who are like both also like young. A lot of them are beautiful, but they're these young women. And they are kind of more diabolical and controlling, and she's more light and airy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, so in some ways she's a prop or a symbol. And you can't get, I mean, she got so brutally murdered that it's like really hard to like, how much are you going to go into who she was that fictionally? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Cause mm-hmm. if you're struggling Bruce Lee, right?
Right. Yeah.
Who knows?
So, hey, let's talk about the ending. So this is going to be spoiler territory. If you've not seen the movie, this is the time to stop the show. Go see the movie because what happens is really cool and it will totally spoil it if you listen to this. So just skip ahead a little bit if you have not seen it. Spoiler alert. So, all right, the ending of the movie. I have two major opinions about this that both kind of form my overall opinion of the film. Okay, so first of all, when we got to the third act, I was starting to get really frustrated because you had these two stories that just felt like they had nothing to do with each other, right? You've got this buddy comedy, Rick Dalton, Cliff Booth thing, which is really fun and cool and great. But then you've got this Sharon Tate thing. And then you get to the end and you can tell, okay, it's murder time. Like Tarantino's going there, okay? Because you start this countdown of the day. It's like 7 a.m., 5 p.m.
Oh, he sets us up.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, and then they talk, they got this voiceover by Kurt Russell saying about who was in the house next. I forgot to mention that Rick Dalton's character lives next door to the Polanskis. So they're next door neighbors.
Can I elaborate on this real quick?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
So in real life, these two houses existed.
Right next to each other? Really?
And they were twin houses.
Oh my gosh.
So one, they weren't exactly the same, but they called them the twin houses because they looked so similar and they had the same architect and everything that you could mistake one for the other. You know, if you weren't familiar with which one was which.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so, but that plays on the stunt double part. But anyway, keep going.
Yes. So anyway, so you've got these, they're living next door to each other. And then, so here we go. You can tell the Manson people are coming and they're going to murder Sharon Tate because Kurt Russell has his voiceover and he's like, here's all the people that were in the house. And then it's like 7 p.m. Then it's 8 p.m. and they're walking up the driveway and it's going to happen. And then what ends up happening is so cool because instead of going to Sharon Tate's house, the Manson murderers go to Rick Dalton's house and encounter a very high Cliff Booth.
Yes. He smoked an acid dipped cigarette that he got from one of the Manson women.
Yes.
And he'd saved it. And and it was like, this was the ceremonial time because they're breaking their relationship off after this end of this film series. Because the DiCaprio character can't afford to keep him as working there anymore because he's got a new wife and all this other stuff.
Yeah. And so that's when you realize the light bulb goes on in your head. This is another revisionist history from Quentin Tarantino. Just like Inglourious Basterds, he's envisioning what if instead of Sharon Tate being brutally murdered, what if she ends up just fine? And what actually ends up happening is these punk Manson kids go to have an encounter with Cliff freaking Booth, say their stupid line about being the devil and here to do the devil's work. And instead of them brutalizing someone else, they get horrifically brutalized themselves. Justice served, and Sharon Tate and everyone lives happily ever after. That is what Tarantino is going for. And I think it's absolutely a brilliant turn, and he totally sets us up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What
were your thoughts on that?
It was fantastic.
Did you see it coming at all?
No.
No.
Oh, I was just waiting for, I was like, oh gosh, am I going to be able to, I'm having to walk out like that. Right, were you thinking like that? Right. I was like, I don't know if I can see like a baby rip from Sharon Tate's womb. I don't know if I can see that.
All our worst fears about to come true of Tarantino and the Manson murders.
And then it gets comic and this, the dog jumps on. I mean, it just, everything starts getting like, it's like funny violent.
Yes.
And silly, even flamethrowers. And like, I mean, it just gets absolutely silly. Right.
Well, this is actually my second counterpoint, and I want to hear your thoughts on this, because I also, the ending, I both loved the concept of it, but I felt like the execution is actually what ended up dragging the movie down a little bit for me, all right? Because the Twitter film universe is going gaga over this movie, saying it's an absolute masterpiece and it's Tarantino's best film, but I felt that the ending was actually a bit of a return to the sophomoric Tarantino that we saw in Hateful Eight. It's that sort of nerdy 15-year-old Tarantino is like, wouldn't it be cool if like the dog like went for this guy's nuts, and then wouldn't it be cool if like Brad Pitt just keeps just shoving her head into that fireplace over and over and over again, and then hey, what if DiCaprio just goes and gets his flamethrower and just chars her right in the pool. You know, you almost see Tarantino as this like nerdy 15-year-old kid making movies. And I feel like that brought it down. That level of like comic violence brought the thing down. And it sort of gets back to that whole myth of redemptive violence, which I know we talk about all the time, but it's just when you're clearly going for this, like you're supposed to be relieved that these punk kids are getting totally brutalized. It starts to make me feel like, yeah, but that's not actually justice, and I actually don't feel good about it. I don't know. What were your thoughts on that?
So it gets you back to, okay, so the name of the movie is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
Which is referential to Once Upon a Time in the West. This is Once Upon a Time in the West, right?
Yeah.
Which is this hyper violent, I think it's a Sergio Leone, a spaghetti western, super violent. And he references all these hyper violent Italian directors. Because the other way it goes is, these guys, you could either like go more harmonious and you get rid of this, like violence is the solution, we need peace, or you go the Italian way.
The Cliff Booth way.
Oh, yeah. And things get crazy quick. Okay. Yeah. And the violence gets just absolutely insane.
Right.
And that's the way Tarantino, he's it's homage to these Italian directors. So he's going to go that direction. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's going to go that direction.
I know. It's his MO. Yeah.
So I'm not like, that didn't freak me out. I like, you know, my sense of it was that it was done, had to be done a little funny, or it would be too serious for us to be palatable.
Had to be that comic edge to it.
Yeah, but then he took it back. So like when their dog bites somebody's nuts, like that's like, it's like we're watching, you know, Coyote and Roadrunner a little bit, right? We're like, no, mm-hmm. Oh, you dropped an anvil on his head, funny. Mm-hmm. But then when somebody's like has their skull bashed in over and over again, you're like, oh, wait a minute. This is real.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, but this is what these kids did to Sharon Tate.
Right.
Should we do this too? I think it was like highly satisfying to watch those Mansonites get like murdered like creatively. But that is what they did to the other people too, right?
I know, but...
So he's using that same thing he did in Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
Which is basically like, we're going to create a Nazi Holocaust in the theater as a solution to the Holocaust.
But see, that's the problem. That is justice to Tarantino, is the bad guy and girl in this case getting what they deserve, right? But we know that justice is more than that. We know justice is bad people being transformed and set free. And I get it. I grew up watching Indiana Jones beat up Nazis, okay? I understand. This is Hollywood 101. I'm just saying, sometimes it starts to rub me the wrong way, especially when it's so over the top like that. It's like Tarantino wants is so bad to be like, all that violence they were going to dish out, it came right back on them. Boom! And you're just like, yeah, but that's not redemption.
But so like what I was thinking about was how their house is the stuntman house for the Tate house, because they're twin houses in real life.
Elaborate.
So, okay. So like they decide at the last minute to go hit that house instead of hit the Tate house. And so the idea is they switch out the house at the last minute for the bad thing that's going to happen.
Hmm.
So it's like the house. So those people function as the stunt double for Tate and her friends.
Interesting.
And they take what the other folks aren't able to take they carry the load.
Yeah.
For that house, because that house is unable to carry that load. And so part of me goes, like I see that there's all this parallelism in the movie. Mm-hmm. I'd also say the other thing that I see in this is that when our narrative is the narrative is either do we want a hero or do we not want a hero? Do we want somebody who's willing to get into the ugly business of like, you know, to deal with violent, like dealing with violent people, get into, go on to Spawn Ranch and go find out if that guy's okay, no matter what it takes. Do we want that? Or do we want to have the illusion that like, we don't need that?
Well, it gets in your definition of what's a hero. If you believe that God is fundamentally nonviolent, then that changes your definition of what a hero is.
Yeah. But I also say like, isn't God fundamentally engaging violence with his own self, like a stuntman?
But through self-sacrifice, not through...
Well, through self-sacrifice, right? But also, like, I would say that's... Yeah, I would agree with that. But I would say there was... I think there's also this characteristic of, like, he's going to check on the old guy, right? And if it ain't right, he's going to do something about it.
That's true. And it's also interesting what you're saying. If you view the two houses as sort of mirrors of or like a backup stunt version of it, then in that way you could make an argument that they are actually taking on the violence onto themselves that was about to be perpetuated onto. So that's interesting, and that is godlike.
Yeah,
despite their methods, but it's not a perfect analogy. But it's
I'm not saying there's direct connection to that.
Of course,
I'm just saying I think that that's interesting. I also think that very oftentimes the hero. Like we're a mixed bag, right?
So yeah.
You get a character like the Pit character, and he is looking out for people that he doesn't have to look out for. Like he does not have to look out for any of these people.
Yeah.
And he does.
That's right.
And he does it in the way that he knows how. And he doesn't go overboard. Like he only uses violence kind of if he has to.
He kind of goes overboard with that one lady who stabbed him, but yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's true. That's true. But like, I mean, the reality. Yeah. And so, but I mean, a lot of times he's just like, he doesn't do it.
Yeah.
But I think like, do we want, are we able to have a hero that exists in a way that's not that doesn't use redemptive violence? Like, is that something that we're capable of? And I don't know if we are.
Mm-hmm. It's very hard to depict anyway. Yeah. So last thing I'll say, as far as that is concerned, and I know this is a bit of a cheap shot, but I will say, if you're a Christian or a fundamentalist Christian and you are very offended by these bad guys getting brutally murdered, I will say that there is a whole sect of Christian doctrine that basically believes that that's exactly what we should be rejoicing in, that God, that's exactly what God's justice looks like, is these people who commit violent acts getting violence thrown back on themselves. So you shouldn't be offended because that's your Christian doctrine.
Wait, but like that's also like the doctrine of like the Psalms.
Okay, but I think but there's a difference. But there's a difference between violence ricocheting back on themselves and God actually performing violence on.
Oh, that you would. Prayers for violence, dude.
It's a fine line. Yeah.
It's there. It's in the Psalms. There's nothing lying about it.
Well, that imprecatory Psalms doesn't. They're inspired, God, but they're not. But they're poetry.
But they're asking God to do violent acts on people.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that that's an accurate reflection of God.
But is it impulse in itself to wish a violent act upon an oppressor? Is that impulse sin?
It's a human impulse, and
is that okay?
Not, yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
So like I feel like I should always have like this positive view towards somebody who's treating everybody like garbage. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, I don't have a positive view.
Mm-hmm.
Like our president. I don't like him.
Yeah.
Sorry, listeners.
Oh no. Yeah,
I don't know if we're gonna lose any of you. I doubt it. He's not a good dude.
No, he's
okay?
Not. Okay. Objectively,
like, I have negative feelings about the guy.
By every standard.
And some of them are wholly negative feelings. Holy, not W, but H. Because it's like, no, this is evil what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I'm not saying it's not just him alone. I'm just giving he's an example that's before all of us. And like those impulses are not wrong. Those are the correct impulse.
Right. Well, I'm right there with you.
Am I going to go like, you know,
right,
go after the president? No.
No. And of course, on our better days, we pray for him because that's what we're instructed to do. That's part of what it means. But at the same time, yeah, you understand the impulse. And I had it just the other day when I found out Jeffrey Epstein was committed suicide in his cell. And, you know, that's a whole thing. And maybe it's a massive conspiracy. It doesn't matter. But assuming that he did commit suicide, because that was the headline when I read it, there was a part of me that was like, you just totally got off easy. Just, you know, spend a life terrorizing young women. And then the second it gets hard, gone, you know, but
that's so you want revenge.
Yeah. That's an evil impulse inside of me, but it's a human one.
You want him to be exposed for who he is in front of everyone, shamed, and then punished.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And it's not, and I'm not saying that's good. I don't think that's a good thing.
Right. So I guess my question is, what is good and what is evil? Because this gets into in this film, are we, as Tarantino telling us to go like, oh, the Manson folks are great and we should really feel bad that they got killed?
Well,
they're going to murder people very violent way.
Totally. But we believe that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, that we believe in a God who actually loved us even when we had nothing inside of us to merit that love. And in fact, when we were openly rebellious, and still pursues us when we're openly rebellious. So enemy love is not only an intricate part of God, it's what he commands us to have inside of us. So
I would say yes, that is a defining characteristic of Christian in the New Testament.
Yeah.
Well, for Christ. I mean, yeah. I say the Gospels.
It's
and Pauline too.
Love your enemies.
Right.
An actual
I would say in the Sermon on the Mount. I would also say it doesn't mean that you don't have enemies.
Right. Right. No. It's not like you have to like everyone and you have to be a hippie that just walks around saying that peace and love, everything's fine. Yeah.
It's not a false peace.
Right. A false peace. Exactly.
And loving your enemies might look it may not look what we might think. It's not like you're going to draw them a picture and tell them that you love them.
Right.
It might look very different. It might mean that you're setting boundaries.
Right.
It might mean that you're not, you can't have contact with them.
100%. Right?
I mean, because yes. I look at because you see all these, people were in, they've been abused or whatever. We're not saying love your enemies sometimes means that you cut contact off.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But it's like with Trump or with Epstein, we don't just have a flowery picture of who they are. We use discernment to judge that their actions are fundamentally opposed to everything we believe is valuable and is worthy of good. But we ultimately hope, I think where enemy love comes is we ultimately hope that they come to their senses and we recognize that they are trapped by their own choices and their own sin and that they need freedom. And that's what we hope for them in the end, right?
And some of these Mansonites convert in not all, not most of them.
But one of them wrote a book about it. Yeah.
Some of them do convert. Now, I don't know. You don't have to like that if you're the family of Sharon Tate.
Right.
But I guess that does occur. What I would say is it also, I think that our temptation to demonize the Brad Pitt character. And I'd be like, and not any more than you want to demonize David.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who basically when wicked people are coming to hurt his people does something. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could get
down a whole tangent about that, but yeah.
Well,
I agree. I agree. It's a human impulse. I just think that it is a sinful impulse to commit violence in any way, and I believe it's fundamentally opposed to the character of God, which is fundamentally nonviolent. I will say that, but I understand that.
So, I am not into redemptive violence. You know I'm not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know I'm not. But I do think it is a stretch to say that if based on the scriptures that God is fundamentally nonviolent.
Well, you read The Crucifixion of the Warrior God by Gregory A. Boyd and will have your life changed.
Oh my gosh. I'm not he will provide a counterpoint for every point. I get that. Okay. But what I would say is, okay, so you give me one book, but I'm looking at the history of all of Christendom. Christianity is inherently violent. You not agree with that?
That's a terrible thing. That's something we should lament.
But it's real.
All the basic sum up of that book is simply that God is like Jesus. And in Jesus, we see not even a shred of violence.
What do you do with the Exodus? What do you do with any of this, this jealous God that you see?
Right. So all scripture is inspired, but that doesn't mean that it's inspired in the sense that God's spirit is flowing through these writers, but how it comes out is a mixture of their ancient Near Eastern understandings of how the gods are and also actual genuine inspiration. And you have to separate that with the litmus test of who Christ is.
But you're reading back culturally, so that's not fair.
That is an ancient practiced by the church fathers.
Hold on a sec. You are taking your cultural scenario and you're putting it onto the ancient scriptures, which is just as...
I'm putting Jesus onto the ancient scriptures, which is what we're supposed to do.
You're taking your cultural scenario, which is in a democratic system where we have tons of privilege and where violence does not benefit the white men who are Protestants. Violence does not benefit us at all. right? Because we already had violence in one.
Sure.
And what you're doing is you're reading back in the scriptures, you're making Jesus peaceful.
But he is.
No, hold on a sec. Is he? He's an insurrection. He's against the Romans.
He's not against the Romans.
Oh, he's absolutely against the Romans. He's leading a messianic revolt. That's how he's interpreted by most of these folks.
That's how he's interpreted, but that's not who he is.
I'm saying he's a threat to the status quo.
Yeah, of course.
But what I think when we want to make everything peaceful, we're saying, well, we don't want to be a threat to the status quo.
No, I think that's a false peace. I'm saying, like, Jesus, when he talks about how, you know, he didn't come to bring peace, he came to bring a sword, it's because he naturally will be divisive. Like, his gospel and his message will be a divisive thing that will cause wars and will cause people to be upset with each other.
So his message will cause wars. Like, so is that, like,
but that doesn't mean that he is inherently violent. Whew.
So his message causes people to fight wars. That doesn't make him inherently violent.
That's a byproduct. That doesn't mean that that's prescriptive.
I follow you. I follow you.
Yeah.
But anyway. I think it's a huge assumption to say that like God is nonviolent, inherently nonviolent, if we're honest about the scriptures.
Well, if we're looking at Jesus and we're looking at a God who died on the cross for his enemies, then that is the
enemy
way.
Love. Yeah, I hear you. But I think, like, we also want to be honest, right? Because we have to approach, if we're looking at a film and we interpret and we saw what we see in the scriptures and we looked at it and we said, oh, this is an inherently nonviolent film, no one would believe us. But we can do that with our own scriptures because we'll come up with a hermeneutic that works because we're reading back culturally.
Interesting. So you're saying if you could film the Bible from beginning to end and then you go back and say, oh, well, this isn't actually...
It makes you a fundamentalist
for
love, which I love that you're a fundamentalist for love. I was saying, how much scripture were you going to ignore?
Not ignoring it. You're interpreting in the light of Christ, which is exactly how God or Jesus told us to do. It's in the road to Emmaus. He said he went back and he interpreted all the scripture in light of himself. What he instructed us to do.
Read the book, man. Read the book.
All right. So before that was stirring. It was a wonderful.
I will usually come on the John side here.
Yeah.
But I do. I am like kind of like, man, you know what? Maybe we don't need another hippie. Maybe we do need a cowboy. I kind of get it.
Feel that way. I just feel like that part of me isn't the God part of me. It's the human part of me.
Oh, it's your, you've run amok.
Yeah.
It's not righteous.
I have a natural.
There is no such thing as righteous indignation anymore.
A righteous indignation against the sin that people commit, but not against the sinner, because that is how Christ instructed us to look at people.
All right.
All right. Okay, we got to wrap this up. So, hey, before we do, what is your one favorite scene from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? If you could pick one scene.
One scene. I love the Bruce Lee scene. I'm not going to lie.
Okay, that was great. That was
because
great.
Who doesn't want to see Tyler Durden fight Bruce Lee?
I love that. Yeah, no, that's a great scene.
That was just fun. That may not be that's not the best scene in the movie. That's fun.
That's your favorite.
I think probably the scene where he goes into the house with the old man.
That's my favorite. It's the Span Ranch scene. That whole sequence with Span Ranch is absolutely, I can't get out of my head. Like, I cannot stop thinking about that scene.
There's something beautiful that he was willing to, like, and the guy didn't even care that he showed up and he didn't recognize who he was, but he was willing to risk everything in order to go make sure that that guy was okay and that he wasn't being taken advantage of or he wasn't dead or he wasn't. And I think that's a pretty amazing scene.
The way it's totally executed too, the tension, how it builds, how these people kind of naturally become more and more creepy, how their excuses seem totally ridiculous and then they're not, but just the way that he plays with us in that scene is incredible.
It's the tension.
Yes.
So he's able to like build this tension that is just kind of amazing.
Yeah.
It felt so samurai, dude.
Mm. It actually felt more like 70s Texas Chainsaw Massacre, kind of like that sort of like rawness, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Weird that we like the same scene, mm-hmm. but I guess that maybe that's like pointing to, hey, maybe that is the scene of impact
I think that's the scene that people will be talking about in 50 years when Tarantino's dead and gone, man. It's a great scene. So, all right, man, that's it. What are your final thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and your letter grade? Go.
My final thoughts are, it is, I think it's a classic. It's brilliant. I pretty much loved everything about it. I considered, because I had this like little window in my schedule today, going and seeing it again because I liked it that much.
Yep.
It caught me off guard with the ending. And the ending really is Sharon Tate lives and everything is wonderful and anti-history. And I thought that was cool. I love all the homage. I love all the allusion, all the reference to Hollywood, that Hollywood era. And Tarantino watches as he watches. I mean, he must spend as much time watching film as he does making films.
Absolutely.
And I appreciate him. And he really is a master. So I give it an A. I think it's that good of a film. It's the best film I've seen this year. There are other films that I think are quirky, other films that I think are kind of breaking. They're kind of breaking convention in some ways more than this film. But I think this film as an overall film is the best one I've seen this year.
All right. So I really like the movie as well. I also have this big urge to see it again. I think I'm going to take my wife, who actually likes Tarantino for some reason. And so
she loves that redemptive violence.
I know. So I think I want to see it again because it's just, I cannot get out of my head. Honestly, I saw it about a week ago and it is just like, can't stop thinking about it. So it's very entertaining movie from beginning to end. Definitely go see it in the theater. And it was such a great rebound from Hateful Eight. I love the concept of the ending. I loved how it ties everything together. I do think, and this is where I will part from you, Tim, is that I do think that the movie is like total 100% surface entertainment, but I think that it lacks some genuine depth to it. And that's why my final grade is going to be a B+. I think, to me, this movie reminds me a lot more of like the Avengers Endgame as far as just like just wonderful surface entertainment. And as compared to my number one and number two. So this comes in at number three for me of the year so far. My number one and number two would be, first of all, The Last Black Man in San Francisco is the best movie I've seen so far this year. Definitely. I don't think anything's going to top it, but we'll see. And then Gloria Bell at number two, which Tim.
This is so weird. Like, I'm into the summer blockbuster.
Yeah. We just had this conversation on Avengers Endgame.
Yeah. And then you're into the character development pieces.
This is
both of those are like people who have a psychological malady who are trying to overcome it and find happiness.
I know. As I was thinking about my final thoughts, I went back to our conversation about this where you were talking about the hot dog versus the steak and kind of we were having this big conversation about what is art.
And now I'm eating hot dogs and you're eating steak.
I think of it more as like...
I think champion of a redemptive violence for some reason tonight.
I think a drink analogy is better. I feel like when you're talking about a movie like The Last Black Man in San Francisco, it's like a fine wine. It's like every time you see it, there's going to be more and more depths on layer to it. Whereas this is more like a rum and coke to me. And I love rum and cokes and I drink them all the time and they get the job done and they're beautiful and they taste good. But to me, I feel like that's the difference. And so I don't know.
It's layered. It's textured. It's fraught with illusion. I disagree.
Okay.
I don't think it's a rum and coke. I think what you have is two. I think they're both wine.
Okay.
And I think what you have with Tarantino is a more complex wine that is ready to roll. I think this is like a tiny vineyard that had a really incredible first offering.
Interesting.
But I don't think it's like, it may or may not be indicative of the vineyard. It might have just worked out pretty good the first one.
Look at you roll with this analogy. I love it.
No, I'm serious.
This is great. This is great.
But I feel like the Tarantino one is like balanced. This one is like more powerful and like you're breaking ground with The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And it's quirky and people are like, ooh, you know, and it kind of, but this other one is like more like, no, if it came down to it and you needed to serve someone really important, you're not going to serve them this. You're going to go with this because you know.
Interesting.
You know that this is going to be acceptable.
I like that. That's good.
But it doesn't degrade either one.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
Nobody's eating hot dogs. Well, that's for the kids.
So, hey, I'm still going with a B+, but like I said, I'm seeing it again with my wife and it might be an A-. And I was really on the fence between B+ and A-, because I get you. I don't think this is like, you know, if you're thinking about a movie that's just sort of breezy, forgettable entertainment, like the whatever that one movie that I'm thinking of with Russell Crowe and doesn't matter.
The other guys?
You know, the other guys.
No,
you know what I'm saying?
The other guys. Nice guys.
Yeah, the nice guys. That's like a movie that you see and you're like, that was fun, and then you immediately forget about. This is a movie that's going to stand the test of time, and it is definitely elevated beyond like just escapist entertainment,
for sure. In his catalog of film, 9 films now, where would you put this?
I would put it near the bottom. Only because he has such a strong canon, okay? I think Hateful Eight is like at the very bottom. But then if you're talking Reservoir Dogs...
Worse than Jackie Brown?
I think Jackie Brown is an incredible movie. Okay. And
I like them all.
And Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. And I love Kill Bill and Inglourious Basterds. I mean, if you're talking about all those movies, I would say I like this a little bit better than Django Unchained. So I would say,
I find Kill Bill that just hasn't held up as well over the years.
I disagree.
Really?
And by the way, there's some speculation that he might bring Kill Bill: The Whole Bloody Affair to Netflix because he has a deal with Netflix now, and so he might
combine them.
There's this cut of the
nine-hour cut.
It's 4 hours with an intermission, and he screened it before at a theater, and apparently it's incredible. So that might come to Netflix. But I think if you take Kill Bill volumes 1 and 2 as a whole, that is a darn fine piece of cinema, and I think it's just it reaches depths that are a little higher than this. But anyway, yeah. But hey, let's talk about that for a second as we close, because Quentin Tarantino has said from the very beginning, and he is standing by it to this day, that he will only make 10 films. 10
what
films. Yes, you didn't know this?
No.
Oh yeah, he said it from Reservoir Dogs that he's making 10 films, and he just reaffirmed that in an interview that I saw with him on the Today Show where he's making one more and that's it, and he's packing it up. And honestly, at first I was frustrated too, but then I'm thinking, what a freaking genius. I mean, think about it, 10 really great movies and then you're out. Right. I mean, he's had a 30-year career. It's not like he has only, you know, made a movies for like a few years of his life. He's had a long career. His movies are great.
Is Grindhouse Death?
What am I calling it?
Death Proof.
Death Proof, it does count as one of them.
It's like barely. It barely counts in my book, but go ahead.
Just think about 10 movies that are going to be talked about by film lovers until God comes back. Dead serious. And then he's off just doing other things, and his reputation is solidified. Isn't that better than like Spielberg, who's made like 60 films and the last 30 have been like, eh.
What are the kids like now?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know. But I'm disappointed too. But yeah.
What else is he going to make?
There's talk of his 10th film being Star Trek film, a Quentin Tarantino R-rated Star Trek film.
That sounds so horrible.
I know.
But it could be so awesome.
But it could be awesome. And apparently he has the blessing from whoever owns the rights to Star Trek to make it rated R, and they are fine with it, with him making it his own thing. And that's interesting.
Is he like a big Trekkie?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a big fan. Now, he hasn't confirmed that officially, but he has, he said that might be his 10th and final film. And they even said, really, that would be your last film? He's like, yep, that would be it. And he was mad at Simon Pegg earlier, a couple weeks ago, because Simon Pegg kept saying, yeah, but it wouldn't, you know, it's not Pulp Fiction or anything. It would be a Star Trek film. And Tarantino was like, it absolutely would be Pulp Fiction. It would be a Tarantino film, because if I make it, it's going to be my movie. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
That is awesome.
I know.
I hope they could subtitle that one, The Whole Bloody Affair also.
So what will be the 10th film by Quentin Tarantino? We'll have probably one more podcast of a Quentin Tarantino movie. Wouldn't that be crazy?
I'm kind of sad.
I know. All right, man. That's it. So, hey, go see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You won't regret it. Even if Tarantino isn't your cup of tea, give it a try.
You should bring your granddaughter.
Oh, jeez.
No,
don't do that.
Don't bring your granddaughter to this film. No. It's a fun movie. I would even think it's a cool date movie.
Yeah, absolutely. If you've got a hip wife, bring her to this movie.
If your wife's uncool, just leave her home. If your husband's uncool, just leave him.
Right.
Just go with your other friends.
Yes. So, hey, we're going to come back next month. We are not taking any more hiatuses, Tim. We've got to get the people what they want. So let's do it again next month.
What do they want next month?
How do you feel about It Chapter 2?
It sounds awful.
We watched the first one and we loved it.
We gave it
an A-.
Sequels.
Yes, but this has, the kids are all grown up. Bill Hader is one of the kids grown up. Jessica Chastain. Would they have really signed on to a terrible script?
Bill Hader's never done anything terrible.
Hey, Barry's fantastic. Come on.
I know you're into Barry. Other people are too. So it must have something.
I don't know. If you're not down for it, we can find something else. But that is the big release. In September.
Because it's for October.
Well, do you know? No. It comes out at the beginning of September. So we'll be able to do it in September, because you know what comes out in October that we're going to do?
Some horrible horror movie.
Joker with Joaquin freaking Phoenix.
I'm not even.
Oh, come on. I thought we talked about this.
I'm not remotely excited about this. Maybe I was
earlier.
Didn't
you see the trailer? You were really excited about this.
Maybe it was the trailer I saw and it looked great.
It looked amazing, and it does look amazing. It's Joaquin Phoenix as a Joker. Come on. Oh, okay.
haven't seen him in anything for a while.
He was in my favorite movie of last year. That one movie where, you know.
Oh, I don't even something anymore.
You don't live. We don't something anymore.
Yeah, something totally like forgot. That. I almost rewatched that because I was like,
it's really good.
You're not the only one that loves
it. It's my number one movie.
Well, I got other friends that love it. So I need to rewatch it.
Anyway, so we'll talk. Sorry.
I'm not at home in this world anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That's a different movie.
Oh.
Just look it up. It's on Amazon.
Am
it's
I really
Joaquin
here?
I can't believe I forgot because I love that movie so much.
I forgot too.
It's on number one on my top 10 of 2018. So go look it up. Anyway, I will talk with Tim. I will talk him into something and we will be back next month. In the meantime, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.